Thanks for listening to this Arrow FM podcast, shared on accessmedia.nz with the support of New Zealand On Air.
All right, hello New Zealand and welcome to another episode of Turn the Page. It's been a couple of weeks since I've been on. I've had a few things on. The first Monday I missed my scheduled airtime. I'd taken a couple of days off because I'd worked the previous weekend for the Wellington Heritage Festival. And then this last one I had a previous engagement where I had to go and talk to some lovely people. So today we are getting back into it. We are reading chapter 2 of Don Farmer's book. Here we are. Chapter 2, Trackside Hunger Games at Matarawa. Ganga Arnold Paget cupped his hands around his mouth and cooeyed out, "Okay boys, down tools, the billy is boiled." That was music to the ears of the relay gang workers, who were only too happy to knock off and escape the midday sun belting down on them as they worked to replace a section of railway line, first having lifted the sleepers to pack out the line with fresh ballast. Although the weather office had predicted it was a clear, warm day, this was turning out to be a classic whited upper scorcher, with the sun's rays beating down and bouncing off the stones in the hot rails. The billy boy had knocked off half an hour or so earlier. It was his job to boil the billy for the morning and afternoon smoko and the lunch break. Downing their crowbars and 10-pound hammers, the men retreated into what meagre shade they could find from a few half-grown trees at the edge of the railway reserve, having firstly fetched their lunch boxes from the old road services bus, now only used to ferry the workers to and from the job each day. They were a diverse bunch of men, mostly from Featherstone, Greytown and Carterton, from many ethnic groups and backgrounds. And like workers everywhere, they had their moments. Occasional rows would break out, words would be exchanged, and sometimes a shirt front would be grabbed in an angry response to provocation. But for 99% of the time, they rubbed along well. It was a case of having to really or suffer them. It was a case of having to really or suffer the misery of being unhappy at work and becoming an outcast. The older men who had been on the job the longest soon figured out where the new recruits stood and how they would respond to having the mickey taken out of them, something that was sure to happen sooner or later. It helped Arnold had a way of keeping things on the level. He was not to be underestimated, a man who kept a firm grip on things, who didn't shy away from confrontation, but was a very fair in his dealings with his men. Having settled down in the shade, the men opened their tucker boxes and bags. Johnny Nowak had something on his mind, and he wanted to share it with his workmates. He lived with his wife and family in a wooden bungalow in High Street, South Carterton. He lived with his wife and family in a wooden bungalow in High Street South, Carterton, but was originally from Eastern Europe. Johnny spoke what could be called pretty good English, although somewhat short on bridging words, and was well liked by the men. He could get very animated when something got under his skin, and this lunchtime it was clear something was needling him. It turned out a week or so ago, he had been walking along a footpath, heading home from where the work bus stopped in Carterton, to let off several of the South End workers. Two young fellows and a grey Austin A40 ute had driven past heading south. They tooted the horn. It was the old... It was the old Auga horn. I thought they must have known me, so I waved. Next night, same thing. Auga, Auga. I turned. I could see one laughing. I glare at them. Two nights ago, same thing. This time, Auga, Auga. I get very angry. I give them two finger, then I shake my fist. His listeners were all grinning broadly, not daring to laugh out loud and upset their workmate. Arnold stopped rolling a cigarette. No, no, Johnny. That's the last thing you should do. It's exactly what the young bucks want. Ignore them, look the other way, or make out that you are writing down the number plate. That will freeze them out. That was Terry Hercock. Notice that Everard was listening to the conversation but not eating. "What's up, Everard? You're not eating," he asked. His workmates knew Everard could never have qualified as a rocket scientist, but his naivety and innocence meant they cut him some slack. They would take the mickey out of him, like they would any other, but stopped short of pushing the envelope too far. Anything that resembled bullying was not tolerated. Everard raised his eyes and confessed, "I forgot to bring my lunch. It's still on the table at home." Arnold came to the rescue. "Oh, for God's sake, Everard, you should have said earlier." "Here, I've got plenty," he said, passing over a sandwich. That set the ball rolling. Tony Rewi took a piece of greaseproof paper from the bottom of his lunchbox and put a sandwich on it and handed it over to Everard. Everard thanked him, putting the greaseproof paper down to use as a makeshift table. It was not the end there. The men realized they could have some fun. George Flutie, Horry Jones, and Ron Farmer joined in, each giving a sandwich. Dick Simonic handed over a slab of fruitcake. "Mabel cooked it. She would love you to have it, Everard," he said. The sandwiches kept coming thick and fast. Ted Carlton took an already peeled hard-boiled egg from his tucker box, sprinkled a sachet of salt on it, and donated it. Further sandwiches joined the collection as Everard, startled and dismayed, but not knowing how to put a stop to their generosity, surveyed the ever-growing pile of food. He made a weak attempt at protesting, saying he had more than enough to eat now, but the boys were on a roll. They took no notice and kept giving. Matt Scott and Pukotaya added the sandwich collection, as did Jack Oakley, and someone tossed half an apple and a banana. Jack Murray added two Anzac biscuits. When the gifting finally stopped, Everard had his lunch in spades. 14 sandwiches in all, 3 with mashed egg filling, 2 tomatoes, 2 cheese, 2 ham, and 1 each of Peck salmon and shrimp paste, lettuce and marmite, luncheon sausage with tomato sauce, corned beef with chow chow pickle, and 1 peanut butter. Completing the platter with a hard-boiled egg, banana, half apple, Anzac biscuits, 2 ginger nuts, the fruit cake, and the stub end of a store-bought Madeira cake. Arnold, enjoying the joke as much as anyone else, but keeping a poker face, declared he would extend the lunch break by 15 minutes. So Everard has a chance to finish his lunch. Taking the mickey as a satirical art, it probably existed since mankind first trod the planet, certainly aeons before Everard's enforced long lunch beside the railway tracks at Matarawa. The arrival of political correctness may have dampened down what is now acceptable, but hopefully the humour taking the mickey brings will never be legislated out of existence. Pubs and clubs are the natural home of its exponents, none more so than the South Wairarapa Workingmen's Club in Greytown in the years that followed the death of 6 o'clock closing. The club had an abundance of pranksters and, am I going to say this? I don't want to say this on the radio. We'll just leave it at that, eh? The club had an abundance of pranksters among its regular clientele, capable of taking the mickey out of anyone, including themselves. Claude Vine was one who could get a chuckle out of the most sombre of men. In earlier days, Claude had been on stage. To what extent was never quite understood, but most believed he had been in vaudeville. He would arrive at the club, often having firstly wet his whistle with a couple of beers at the club hotel, or bottom pub, as it was always called, and then the show would get underway. A favourite stunt was to swallow a lighted cigarette, and he could do it. Claude would partly smoke the cigarette, and then by a flick of the tongue appear to swallow it, fully closing his mouth. After a couple of seconds, he would open his mouth and flick the cigarette back between his lips, still burning. It was the sort of stunt you would warn others not to try at home, or anywhere else for that matter. Among the collection of all sorts of odds and sods gathered behind the club's bar over the years was a genuine police constable's helmet. One Christmas Eve, as the bar was in full swing and the shops were open late for business, Claude decided he would go on the beat. He convinced the chief club steward, John Hickson, to hand over the helmet along with the club torch and stepped out onto Main Street. From there, watched by drinkers who gathered in the front foyer to watch the proceedings, Claude patrolled down the street, stopping to quiz shoppers going about their business, wearing the helmet and shining a torch beam in their faces. All was going well until the town's real-life policeman, twice the size and weight of Claude, and also on the beat, approached from the other direction. Claude was escorted back from whence he had come, helmet off, and head under his arm, along with the Christmas Eve caution that he was to not ever again impersonate a policeman. Now, I may take a break there, because I think we're about halfway through that chapter. I'll read two more. Keith Heck Garrity had his regular spot at the bar just to the west of the last set of beer taps bordering the takeaway area. He hastily referred to himself as a permanent fixture, a description not entirely true, but perhaps with the same foundation, or some foundation. Heck worked at the Waingawa Freezing Works and the tannery, work that was seasonal, but when it was in full swing meant early starts and early knockoffs. Hence, he would be in the club usually no later than 3 p.m., prepared to put in a long day before heading home to the house he shared with his mother Ruby in McMaster Street. Prior to being a freezing worker, Heck had worked in construction and along the way had lost part of his little finger on one hand in a workplace accident. Inconvenient as that may have been at times, it had its upside. Heck liked nothing better than to stand at the bar when an out-of-towner arrived and settled in along next to him. Usually it would be a visitor from an affiliated club. He would casually put the stub of his little finger to his ear, twist it and turn it, or sometimes to a nostril and grimace. To all intents and purposes, it appeared a good inch or two of the finger had been crudely buried into an orifice, seeking out wax or worse. Heck had the knack of keeping a straight face and looking convincingly. He also had his own version of the English vocabulary. Ooh. I think we're going to skip that particular chapter so I don't get in trouble. Right. On Saturday mornings, the club's most loyal imbibers, Heck amongst them, started to arrive and gather at the bar before opening time, waiting for the slides to be raised, eager to get their taste of a dog that had bitten, or at least nibbled at them the night before. On this day, Heck had a story to tell of an audience. When I left here last night, I headed north along Main Street and crashed straight into the back of a bus, he said. Were you okay, he asked. Well, the impact spun me around. I veered across the road and collided with a power pole. Just as well I was walking. Heck, although very young when World War II broke out, had firstly been in the Home Guard and then enlisted with the Navy to join the fight. He had his own reasons for doing so. I figured we had to beat the Japanese. If they invaded New Zealand, I didn't want to be pulling a rickshaw over the Rimutuckers. On quiet nights, the bar staff could be put the ring around having at least two customers, Heck at one extremity of the bar and Bill Flood at the other. Both drank 5-ounce beers in glasses, known as ladies' waists, and wasted no time in emptying them. Although it was never proven, staff were always suspicious, the two worked in unison just to make sure the bar steward was kept busy. Heck's glass would be filled, only to find Bill would be in the throes of draining his and vice versa, and this continued unabated. Right, take a break now, give my voice a bit of a rest. I'm going to play a piece of music completely unrelated just because I like it and just because I was listening to it before and cut it short because I wanted to make sure I was here on time. So this is one of my favourite Get Up and Go songs. It is Johnny Farnham, You're the Voice.
Yeah.
And that was Johnny Farnham, You're the Voice. And just going back a little bit, so we're talking about Heck and Bill. They spoke across the bar to each other, but resisted any suggestion they stand side by side to save the steward's soul leather. Bill's love of the F-word was legendary, not so much because of the word itself, but how he managed to unconsciously inject it into speech. A kerosene tin became a kero-bleeping scene tin. The Rema Tuckers became the Remu bleeping Tuckers, and so on. Bill had become completely oblivious to the habit. Among the not-so-regular drinkers were old Bert Mason, a real gentleman and everyone's favourite. Bert was more than a day or two over 80, many days in fact, but he was young at heart and ready for any challenge life presented. He didn't mind the mickey being taken out of himself and rather enjoyed it, and on one occasion he got his own back. The club's pool team had taken up the challenge to play in the Greytown Hotel top pub. It was during the working week, and a couple of the club's regular players were unavailable for that night's games. The team captain desperately scouted around to fill the gaps. He managed to rein in standbys, but fell one short. It was then that old Bert volunteered. The rest of the team were pretty reluctant to risk Bert. After all, he was getting on. Walked with a stick, and was totally untried at pool. Nevertheless, beggars could not be choosers, and Bert was signed up. The top pub team was a strong combination. They would take a lot of beating. Surprisingly, in a close go, Bert won his singles, an achievement some club members put down to good luck rather than good management. He lost the doubles, but his partner had to shoulder half the blame for that. At the end of the doubles, it was the even Stevens. Everything depended on the final match, the team game. It proved to be a nail-biter, with the club getting a slight edge, but as fate would have it in the final act, to sink the black and win the game fell to old Bert. More than one team member took a few seconds to approach Bert. "Do you think you can do it, Bert? It's not an easy shot." Bert took a hard look at what was ahead of him. They were right. It was an oblique angle. "Here, hold that," said Bert, handing the cue to the player beside him. With that, he walked around the table, picked up his walking stick, as all and sundry watched, wondering what the old man was up to. Bert stepped forward, and in the quickness of an eye, lined up the shot with his walking stick, hitting the cue ball perfectly into the black and sinking it. The hero of the hour had taken the mickey out of the whole damned lot of them. Bar staff often succeeded in taking the mickey out of customers. For some unknown reason, and by means unknown, a bale hook, used to throw hay bales into the backs of trucks and sheds, had become a club possession. It had no practical use whatsoever in the bar, but steward Fred Sexton would often find humour in just about anything, and whose loud laugh resounded throughout the club at regular intervals, found a way to enjoy it. Again, a visitor to the club would become the target. Fred would pull the hand of his left arm inside the sleeve of his jersey, and grip the small horizontal handle of the bale hook, and would leave just the fierce-looking metal hook protruding. The unsuspecting drinker ordered a brew. Fred would casually pop his hook hand on the counter, but could not sustain the ruse for long and would burst out laughing at the look on the victim's face. One quiet afternoon, in the cahoots, another staff of Fred got the drop on a trio of club members who had arrived at the bar. The three, Clive Benton, Bruce Donald, and Doug Eglinton, were all from Featherstone. Clive was leading the way, and reaching the bar was berating his companions over the merits or otherwise the brands of whiskey. To Fred, he said, "I hope you have a Macleay Duff on the Bowser. It's the only whiskey worth drinking. Beautiful stuff." Fred took a look and confirmed there was no bottle in use. Fred took a look and confirmed there was a bottle in use. "Give us three doubles, no ice, no water," Clive said. The spirits Bowser was mounted on the section of the bar at right angles from where the trio were standing out of their sight. It was then the stewards realised they could take the mickey. Instead of the prestigious Macleay Duff Scotch whisky, they poured a double shot of New Zealand's own Wilson's whisky into each glass. "Now try that," said Clive to his companions, at the same time taking a sip from his own glass, then doubting the remainder. beautiful stuff, isn't it?" he asked. Bruce and Doug agreed. It was good stuff. "Now," said Clive to Fred, "give us one of those New Zealand whiskies, just a single, so we can taste the difference." Things were working out perfectly. Fred went back to the Bowser, returning with the three Wilsons in which reality was MacLeay Duff. Clive took a sip and wrinkled his nose. "There you go, this stuff is just rubbish." And his two companions had little opinion but to agree. Little option but to agree, sorry. I'll read that again. "There you go, this stuff is just rubbish." And his two companions had little option but to agree. There was no way the stewards were going to own up to anything. To Clive, that would have been a red rag to a bull. Electrician Max Wilson fell victim to a prank when he was called to check on a power problem. In the quiet and early afternoon, with only a couple of die-hard drinkers in the bar, Max was searching for the cause of the glitch. In company with John Hickson, he opened the metal door of the huge switchboard. With their backs to the bar, neither man noticed the second steward move quietly behind them, carrying a fully extended brown paper bag. Carrying a fully extended brown paper one-bottle bag blown up like a balloon. As Max peered in, about to check the fuses, the steward brought his free hand down with full force onto the bag. It burst with an ear-splitting bang that sent both men skywards in unison, clawing the air. "You stupid idiot," was the judgment passed on the steward, one which made no impression on him or the drinkers who had watched the proceedings, all convulsing with laughter. Clever thinking spared Duki Rewi from having the mickey taken out of him. Up to 20 mostly senior members gathered to play... I don't know what that word is. Ochre? Euchre? E-U-C-H-R-E. Euchre. In the lounge bar, and although it was a social occasion, it was no frivolous affair. The competition was fierce, and reputations were at stake, and partners were expected to be up to the mark. On this afternoon, Duki had left his home in Papawai, knowing that he was running a bit late, and arrived at the club with only a minute to spare before the card packs were shuffled. As he was about to enter the playing room, he saw a scrunched-up dollar note lying on the carpet and realised it had to belong to a fellow card player already in the room. But who? Duki was as honest as the day was long, with scruples. When he picked up the dollar, he realised, and it was, in fact, not a single dollar, but two notes wrapped around some coins. Duki approached the bar staff, who told them of the find, and how he would determine who the owner was. "If you would just announce that money had been found and for the owner to see me, that would be great. But they have to tell me how much money they think they have lost before they get it," he said. With that, Duki went in to join the Ochre squad. An hour passed and the players broke for their usual half-time drinks and chatted in the main bar. Duki was not a happy man. Not only was the owner not being found, but more than half of the men and women playing the cards had sidled up to him, laying claim to it. "I think I lost $10. I've lost $5. I'm short $3. None of them had been able to tell him the right amount. Half-time over, the players got back to work. Within a few minutes, Duki approached the bar staff during a short break in the proceedings. "You can tell the players the owner has been found and the money has been returned." Several asked who lost it, but they were not told. Duki merely said it was not up to him to tell them. Money matters were private, end of story. But it wasn't. A couple of weeks passed before Duki felt he just had to reveal the true story to the bar staff. It turned out that the cash had been returned to its rightful owner, Duki Rewi. On the afternoon it had all happened, Duki had made a dash to the club, but first he had to top up his little car with petrol. He stopped at the Shell service station in town, and without wasting any time, filled up, paying in cash, and shoving the change into his pocket. At the club he walked briskly through the main room, but, on recall, remembered he had actually stopped very briefly at the bar to talk to a staffer, then retraced his steps to approach the lounge bar, again noticing the money on the floor. The amount he picked up tallied precisely with the change he had received from the service station, and surreptitiously checking his pockets, Duki realized it was his change. Now, he hadn't noticed dropping it. Heaven only knew. Too red-faced to admit what had happened, Dookie had fallen back onto the privacy excuse when asked the question of the ownership, and in doing so survived what no doubt would have been a prolonged ribbing from his fellow Uka players. It was a textbook example of how to avoid having the mickey taken out of you. Right, that is us for today. I'm pretty sure, 95% sure, I will be here on Monday. I'm not going to have another couple of Mondays off. So we will catch up with you Monday. Have a brilliant week. And yeah, we'll continue through Don's book. We've still got quite a few to go. We should be further along than we actually are, but that's all right. These things happen. Have a great week. Look after each other. And we will see you in a week.